and get started. So I'm very pleased to have Bob Kaiser with us today. We kind of had to twist his arm a little bit to do this, but we don't get to hear from him all that often. So it's very nice to be able to learn a little bit about what he's been doing. And so the topic today is looking at the EU accession and the politics of rescaling in the Estonian-Russian borderlands. And I can tell you that if you just don't get quite enough of it today, that he's giving another part of the talk on Tuesday, yes?
On Tuesday.
Yeah, it'll be down at the Pyle Center. It's part of a WUN series that the Geography Department is running. There'll actually be a video of this that we can link up to our website, so we can take care of that as well. So I really feel that Bob needs no introduction with this group. He's a professor in the Geography Department. He's currently the associate chair of the department, and he's been the director of CREPA, very active in the field, and spends a lot of time, I guess, now in Estonia, right?
Yeah, so, or back and forth.
Back and forth.
Crossing the bridges.
That's right, yeah. That's right. So that's what he'll tell us about. So let me just mention what we have next week. If I can find it. Who's next week?
We're really excited to.
Oh, right. So next week we move to the West, and we have the Hungarian Roma self-governance, help or hindrance, by Robert Kulish from Goucher College. So I hope we'll see you there. We're trying to get a mix of different geographic areas, so this will be something for the East European aficionados. So let me turn it over to you, Bob. Okay.
Although Estonia, as we all know, is the very heart of Europe.
Yes.
You'll hear about today. Well, just as a way to introduce the topic, I've been going and doing work on the Estonian-Russian border for now, I guess, over 5 years. And this is a piece of that research. There is a paper behind this called The Performativity of Scale, and looking at some of the politics of scale literature and trying to bring some of Judith Butler's work into the picture. I'll give you a tiny, tiny little piece of that today. And then the talk on Tuesday actually is at least the front part of that, is a paper that has just come out in the September issue of Ethnic and Racial Studies, trying to reconceptualize borderlands and then bring that to the southern area of the border. So what I'll talk about today is mostly the northern part, the part that is still predominantly ethnically Russian. And particularly I'll talk about Narva and sort of what's happened there. I'll give you, so to give you sort of a sense of what you're in for, I'll give you a tiny little bit of EU accession, then I'll try and keep constrained on theory, but I'll dump some theory on you, and then I'll take you to the region itself and look at the different processes through which Narva has been sort of rescaled. And I've given the topic EU accession, but that Europeanization is really only sort of the last process of rescaling. And I want to talk about, I want to go back to post-World War II period, this process of internationalizing Narva in sort of in a Soviet way, a proletarian internationalism that was brought out to the city and how it remade the city. I'll then talk about Estonianization following independence in the city, trying to remake Narva as Estonia and the consequences of that, and then how that worked together with that bringing Europe out to the borderlands as well. So that's what you've got in store, and I clicked twice. That's not a good thing. I'm not used to the clicker. I'm used to the little arrows. Okay, so just the little piece, and I don't know if that light's okay, if you can see the screen all right.
No, it's fine.
Okay. Well, as probably everyone in the room knows, on May 1st, 2004, Estonia joined the EU. Really, from the time I began going to the field and out to the border areas, the EU presence was already pretty strongly felt, if not predominant, in the early part of this decade. The second thing to note is that Estonia's return to Europe, this discourse of a return to Europe that became dominant in the second half of the 1990s, it was really used as a way to discursively and in practice stretch Europe out to the border with Russia. Okay, and this is a process of trying to reclaim an area that had been treated and thought of as the exterior of Estonia prior to that time. And this, of course, had the effect of pulling Narva into the West and away from Russia and Russianness. And the thing that I'm looking at and the question I have is, well, what about the people? Overwhelmingly ethnically Russian, what's become of them is this place has been sort of westernized, Europeanized, Estonianized out from under them. What do they make of it? How do they respond to it? And so these are the kind of questions I've been asking, been doing a lot of interviewing over the last 5 or 6 years, and I'll give you the results of that today. But first, a little theory. Now, first of all, I'm not assuming you understand you could understand it, but that you've even heard the phrase politics of scale. So I'll talk a little bit about this area just in very broad terms. What I'm doing with it is something very different, so I'll try and introduce you to that since that's what I'm going to try and employ when I go out to the area. And first of all, the idea within the politics of scale literature is that I think we've come to see scales as sort of naturalized things in space out there in the world. And within this literature, the dominant conclusion, the dominant sort of take-home point is that scales, like much else that we know about the world, are socially constructed, that they aren't ontologically given things in the world, but they are more, or should be seen more, as epistemological ways of seeing the world. Okay, and I think that's sort of the only thing I really want to say about the politics of scale literature. Most of it's dominated by a political economy framing. What I'm trying to do is really use post-structuralism and particularly performativity to sort of rethink how we sort of understand scales and the politics behind this process of scaling. And so the second point that I have on this slide is this idea of performativity of scale. And performativity of scale, as I see it, can be defined as sets of reiterative or citational practices producing scale effects. And the simple way of thinking about that, I think, is you could think about nationalization producing Estonia in Narva, and I'll give you some examples of that, or Europeanization, a transnationalization, a rescaling set of practices that produce Europe in Narva, as a case of that. Just to give you a little background on performativity, Judith Butler's work, and this is in From Bodies That Matter, defines performativity as the reiterative and citational practices by which discourse produces the effect that it names. And her work, of course, has much more to do with identity and the whole question of gender and sex. And so I've got this second part that I wanted to include simply to say, well, what am I looking for when I actually go out there? I'm looking for these practices, but I'm also looking for how scale gets to be naturalized, how it gets to be seen as this sedimented effect. And so I like this phrase because it both talks about those reiterative performances that make, in Judith Butler's terms, make sex look like just a natural thing, a biological thing that's out there in the world. Just as scales are seen as sort of natural things that are out there in the world, but also that through these performances themselves and the reiteration of them, gaps and fissures open up in the performance of sexes and identity in her terms, in my terms, in these reiterative practices that produce scale effects, there are also gaps and fissures that open up, unintended consequences of these scaling practices. And I'm looking for those as well as I'm out there. Okay, and then I think it's the final theoretical slide. So I can't really talk about scales. I can't talk about the global or Europe or the state or Estonia doing things if they're not ontological categories or things in the world. So I've reframed this and really approached this by looking at, rather than looking at scales, looking at the actors, the political actors, and the scalar stances that they take, actors that represent Estonia in the region, actors that represent Europe there, and why they do the things they do, what are the politics behind that. The reason to bring scale into the picture at all is that it's an instrument of power, and I've been convinced over the course of the last 4 or 5 years that that instrument of power has been directly deployed in order to create gaps or to create separation, disjunctures between identity on the one hand and place on the other. Okay, and so rescaling as a set of discursive practices can be used to join place and identity together to sort of remake them, re-narrate them, but it can also be used to pull them apart, and Narva clearly used to pull them apart. And I think that's basically what I'm talking about, Narva being Estonianized, Europeanized, to pull it into the West, but also then exteriorizing Russians and Russianness from it, where the population is sort of left there. And then my question is, well, what happens to the population? Can it use the politics of scale to do something about that exteriorization? So this is how I'm looking at it. As I say in the last point here, rescaling Narva as Europe is really only the latest phase in this process. And we go back historically and look at lots of these. I'm only going to go back to World War II. Which even that is probably more than I can handle in however much time I have left. But let me take you to the region then and show you how I'm using this understanding of scale and the politics behind it to sort of look at how Narva itself has been remade, rescaled over the course of these last 60 years or so. And first of all, it's important to note that Narva was destroyed during World War II. There's a great deal of contestation about who destroyed Narva, whether it was the Nazi army or the Soviet Air Force, and it was undoubtedly a combination of the two. But that becomes a part of that story and a part of that process of rescaling as well that I'll talk about in a bit. When it was rebuilt, it was remade to represent a proletarian international site, or a site of proletarian internationalism. This is the first rescaling that I want to talk about, that internationalization of Narva and a way to understand what Narva is during the Soviet era. Now, the first part of this was the Russian in-migration of workers that happened in the first place. These populations, overwhelmingly young populations, working class populations, coming from all over the Soviet Union, not from one place transplanted to another. And this population itself was seen as a Soviet population that was bringing Soviet identity with them. Okay, so not Russians, but Soviets. The second part of that is that the border that runs along the river between Narva and Ivangrad, the city on the Russian side, is a border in name only and symbol only. It's a line on a map that isn't discursively practiced during the Soviet period. It's an open bridge with no checkpoints, no signs to tell you that you're leaving one place and entering another. In practice, it didn't affect how people lived out their daily lives. Narva, and the place we're talking about right here on the border between Estonia and Russia. And here, sort of in a close-up, what I want to talk about initially is that this really is a trans-border city. And it developed this way even historically before the Soviet period, but certainly during the Soviet period it developed in this way. People chose to live on one side of the border or another, not with the border in mind, but because housing was available, because it was close to shops, because it was close to work, because it was close to transportation networks, and so on. If they had sisters or brothers that lived on the other side of the border, it didn't matter, because the border didn't materialize on the ground during this period of time. The second part, so this idea of a trans-border Soviet city is sort of the second point that I want to make about that Sovietization, proletarian internationalism in the city, that it is seen as a transnational city. And the third is this idea of Krenholm as a site. This is a textile manufacturing plant built in the 19th century that is seen and treated as a symbolic site of proletarian internationalism within this Soviet period. History is rewritten to emphasize the socialist revolutionaries that rallied workers and struck for better wages and things during the 19th century. As an example of that, there are still statues to some of these characters around. Krenholm itself becomes an icon of proletarian internationalism, and I'll give you a couple of images of that. Here's an old picture of that with the Narva Falls. Here's a stamp commemorating the 100th anniversary. So in stamps and posters and lots of different ways, this becomes seen as a site of proletarian internationalism, not only to internationalize Narva, but now almost the idea of Krenholm as a site to internationalize the Soviet population itself. And as I think I had on the previous slide, if I can go back to it, I can. That during this period of time, Krenholm was actually seen as the preeminent place to go for tours of Narva. And in the tour guidebooks, they list those sites that groups should consider going to, Krenholm Manufacturing Number 1. There were large-scale tours that took place there. So not the old medieval fortress and things like that, but Krenholm, to show them what Narva was really about. The second and third sites, in terms of the places that people were directed to, one was the shale oil electric generating plant, the one on your left. Still the plant that produces around 90% of all electricity in Estonia. And then the hydropower plant as other sort of symbols and understandings of what it meant to be Soviet. So this idea of proletarian internationalism through this industrialization and industrial infrastructure was sort of not only used as an image, but also sort of used for tours and so on to internationalize the population. Well, the intended effect of all of this was to bring Sovietization or to Sovietize the understanding of Narva. So Narva as the Soviet Union, Narva as a proletarian international site was the intended effect of all of this. But the thing that I found and that really struck me as I was doing this research both historically and also then talking to some of the people that came into Narva during the 50s in particular is that the unintended consequence, the gaps and fissures, if you will, that opened up in these scale effects was a localization of the population. A population that fundamentally re-understood its existence, its meaning, its identity as local. So that local scale effect sort of prominently on display, the idea that we're Narvans here, that we came to remake the city, we rebuilt the city, and we were remade into Narvans in the process, was a story I heard again and again by this older generation. Not primarily we're Soviet people, not primarily we're Russians, but primarily we're Narvans here. Okay, and that clearly was not an intention of this proletarian internationalization of Narva during the Soviet period, but it's something that's had long-lasting consequences in this post-Soviet era as well, and I want to come back to that closer to the end. Now, what about post-Soviet rescalings then, beginning in actually as early as the late 1980s, but certainly in the 1990s? Well, the first thing that happens is that bordering practices change fundamentally. They materialize on the ground in a very serious way. So now there are border post fences. You don't cross the border without a passport and a visa. This has, of course, stranded or marooned friends, neighbors, relatives on one side looking across. And I've sat with people looking out their windows and saying, well, my sister lives in that apartment over there, and asking them, well, when was the last time you saw her? Well, you know, 1989 or 1990. So, and not because we had a falling out, but because the border is sort of a real practice. You can think of all of those social networks that get severed as a result. The other consequence, people who bought or lived on the Evangorod side in housing that was provided for them by Krenholm lost their jobs in Krenholm because Krenholm ended up on the Estonian side. So lots of consequences in social, economic, cultural terms for this population. The second thing that I think is important to note, and something that I was really struck by as I went to the region for the first few times, is that during this period of the Soviet period, within Estonia and Estonian national discursive practices, Narva was seen as a Soviet city. It was exteriorized from what it meant to be Estonian, where Estonia was. So even if it was inside Estonia and the borders, in terms of popular culture, in terms of the way of talking about and thinking about the city, it was not Estonian. Okay, and so this sort of carried over even into the last few years when I started going to the place. And the first time I remember very clearly, I was in Tartu at a tourist office and went up to one of the agents there and said, well, I need to book a hotel room in Narva. And instead of sort of getting the guide out and finding me the places and the prices and then sort of contacting the right people to make the reservation, she looked at me and sort of frowned at me and said, why would you want to go there? And then proceeded to tell me all of the things I've got here, how dangerous the place was, how it was a crime-ridden place, how it was a place of disease as well. Well, and I've heard this story over and over again. This has really become a part of Estonian popular culture, a way of understanding Narva and also, I think, Russianness. So my sense of this is that this is a way of actually, these are metaphors for or stand-ins for what it means to be Russian. And most of these people had not been to Narva. Of course, when I got there, I was expecting the worst. When I rented a car, also the car rental agent, when he found out where I was going, did not want to rent me the car. And then he wanted me to take extra insurance. Then he wanted to make sure I parked in a secure lot. And I refused to do all those things, just as a little experiment. And the car wasn't dented or scratched or stolen or anything. So, you know, the place is very different, in other words, from that understanding, that popular cultural image of the place that you get from outside. And I think that stands up even in popular culture, even though in Estonia, in an official sense, there's been an active effort to interiorize Narva since about the mid-1990s. And so I want to talk about that Estonianization of Narva, the attempts to sort of pull Narva back into the meaning of Estonia and Estonianness, how that rescaling has sort of worked out on the ground there. And the last thing that I want to talk about is the way in which Europeanization with the coming of the EU has been used in discursive practices in conjunction with this Estonianization to pull Narva into the West and also then to sort of separate Narva from the Narvans living there and their understanding of who they are. Okay, so the border station, as it looked when I first got there, a line of cars. There are, unlike a lot of places in much of the world, there are customs and passport stations on both sides of the border, so four checkpoints that you have to go through. To walk through, if you have the right visas and passports, takes about 45 minutes, so not too bad unless the line is long. To go through by car in 2005, it took typically somewhere between 4 and 10 hours. In a tractor trailer going across with goods, it was averaging over 24 hours in 2005, so about 26 hours because of all of the inspections and all of the slowdown. Clearly, this is a materialized border in terms of discursive practices. It's not just a line on a map anymore, and that's fundamentally changed social, economic, cultural reality on the ground.
Is that from the Estonian side?
That was from the Estonian side. This is the Bridge of Friendship, created in the Soviet period. The legend is named by the Narvans themselves to signify the closeness and familial ties and feelings between Estonia and Russia. Well, it's not looking too friendly anymore, of course, with barbed wire fence and all of these customs posts on both sides of it. This is the main crossing point. You can see that's sort of a typical line of cars sitting, waiting to get into the Russian side. So rescaling Narva as Estonia. It really has a series of a set of discursive practices that goes along with it. Estonianization, sort of the obvious things, and I'll show you some examples of that. De-Sovietization, of course, is a major part of this as well. De-Russianization happens, and this has happened in terms of not only the things I'll highlight because they're good visual aids, the sort of cultural monuments and architecture and things like that that's been transformed, but of course this has also been a transformation of political elites, of cultural elites, of economic networks and flows that are not looking eastward anymore but turning westward. Now the population there is still about 3% ethnically Estonian, but overwhelmingly all of the directors and mayor's office and all of these positions of power are held by Estonians. So a part of that process is an Estonianization of elites themselves, who then in turn enact that process of Estonianization on the ground. But also monuments, museums, cultural events, and festivals, a whole range of things to bring Estonia to Narva. And I've got the map up here again. really just to remind myself to point out that a lot of this Estonianization and certainly a lot of this Europeanization goes on not just all around the city, but goes on in particular right along the border. And it's really striking, especially when you first get there, how many monuments sit right on the riverbanks, almost as if this is a case of territoriality and a marking of territory has gone on now in a cultural sense rather than in other ways of marking territory that we might think about. First, de-Sovietization. This is the Lenin that stood on the main town square and now is the only Lenin to remain in Estonia. So he does still exist in Estonia, but now he is, and I think very sort of suggestively, encased within the walls of the medieval Danish-built fortress. So this idea of de-Sovietization sort of powerfully on display here. Now, instead of a symbol of power and Sovietization, he's become a kitschy sort of thing that tourists, as they come get off the buses to go to the castle, they also will get their picture taken next to Lenin. The second thing is that it's happening. There are just a series of these monuments to World War II and to the liberation, as the Soviet Union framed it, the liberation of Narva, Estonia, and all the West from fascism. This is one of those monuments, a tank monument, a tank that actually did function. And the rereading of these monuments from the idea that they were sites of liberation to the idea that they are actually symbols of occupation has been sort of an ongoing process at work in Estonia, and particularly with reference to this site. I think because of the material reality of a tank sitting there, this monument in particular has been one that's drawn a lot of attention by Estonians. And one suggestion is that it should go into the occupation museum that has been built in Tallinn or another occupation museum that's being created in northeastern Estonia. So occupation museums and then sort of the relocation of a lot of these symbols of Sovietization but symbols of liberation moving into these.
Occupation referring to Soviet?
The Soviet occupation, and in the text of the occupation museum, there are three occupations, the initial Soviet one, then the Nazi occupation, and then finally the Soviet occupation that began in 45 and came up till 91. And in the text of that, the text basically says, and the Nazi occupation was the mildest occupation that Estonia suffered. So there's sort of a clear effort to talk about the meaning of the Soviet period for Estonia and Estonianness, not just in Narva, but in the state as a whole. Well, de-Sovietization isn't just taking things away. It's also putting things in place that weren't there before. The monument to the left has been created during this period as a monument to the deportation that took place, and it sits right outside the train station. So the deportation of Estonian elites when the Soviet Union came in following World War II. And this monument, again, this idea of re-narrating history, this monument is a monument which was vandalized at the time I took the picture. I didn't do it, but somebody the night before did. Is a monument to the destruction of the city itself that basically says on this day the Soviet Air Force bombed the city into annihilation. So again, there isn't sort of the Nazi army did this and the Air Force of the Soviet Union did this, but rather the Soviet Union did it. The other symbolic way of Estonianizing, of course, is to use this whole complex. Here's the river that is the border, the river actually out here. This is a little wading and swimming pool. And the river is the border. This, on the right, Ivangorod, a very Slavic-looking fortress. The fortress on the left, that Narva castle, Narva fortress, a very European, Danish-built, European-looking fortress. So marking off Estonia in this way, too, with the text of these two fortresses actually acting as opponents facing off against one another. Here's the text coming out of the brochure of the Estonian Tourist Board, this brochure from 2005. So you can sort of get that sense of how this border is visualized and sort of the discourse associated with this strong divide between Estonianness and Estonia on the one hand, Russianness and Russia on the other hand. This text almost gives you the impression that Ivangorod Fortress comes first. In fact, it follows by a couple of centuries the Danish fortress. The other sites, there are lots of sites of Estonianization. I'll only point to a few. This is probably the preeminent site of Estonianization. If you think about it, it's almost a recolonization of Narva, a planting of the Estonian flag and Estonian-ness in the city itself. This is Alexandria Lutheran Church. It's the largest by volume Lutheran church in Estonia. Estonia and Estonians are Lutheran by religion. The reason it's there is there was a large Estonian population that worked at Krenholm, and it was there to service their needs. It, of course, during the Soviet period, was not a functioning church, used as storage. You could maybe see many of the windows still are missing. But it also is one of the sites that's gained most of a large amount of investment in the restoration and rebuilding of the city. And it's a sort of a question why, because there are just 3% of the population Estonian, and so it's not there to service a large Estonian population's needs. It's actually there as a stage of Estonianization. It doesn't hold regular services on Sunday, even in summer, and you can imagine it can't really do it in winter until they do something about the windows. Oh, let me go back just to point something out. It is relatively rare, in my experience at least, to see a national flag flying just below the cross in a church, which gives you sort of an idea of what this church is, what it is a stage for. Instead of being used as sort of a regular place for church services, it is a site for cultural Estonia. This is Estonia's most well-known pianist who came to give a performance when I was there. And there are sort of a string of these kind of performances that go on. Estonian national choirs that come in to give performances. I'm not quite sure why he has little wings, but they are wings, and he flaps them like he's a bee when he gets done with a performance. He's a crowd pleaser, I think. But that's sort of beside the point. The other thing I saw a couple of years ago, a Fellini play, again, sort of that merger of Estonian-ness and European-ness, Estonian play, but all in the Estonian language, that was actually staged within the Alexandria Church. So all of these sorts of cultural things happening rather than the church as a Lutheran church to service a local population. Now, I should say that the church isn't being reconstructed with the idea that large numbers of Estonians are going to come and live in Narva, but what it does do is it stages these events, and Estonians from all over Estonia do come to actually participate in those events. To some extent, that may be a good thing. It at least exposes them to what Narva is and what it isn't in a more fundamental way than they get from that popular cultural scene. But nonetheless, it isn't, you know, it does different kinds of things. In that way, you can sort of see Estonians and Estonia sort of being pulled out to the region. This is another site, an actual cemetery with a monument that is reconstructed that commemorates the 1918, the soldiers who fought in the War of Independence, and there are just lots of these sorts of things around. Old Narva days at the Old Town Hall, and I'll come back to the Old Town Hall, built before the Russian period of control that began in 1704, that has been sort of a staging ground for a lot of these Estonian events as well. And what it really, in my mind, is doing is transforming both history and present and future into a time space of Estonian-ness, of European-ness, that is also exteriorizing Russian-ness from the time space of Narva today. They may belong in the Soviet era Narva, they may belong in the imperial Russian era Narva, they don't belong in this Narva, is sort of what is striking about these things over and over. Here's an Estonianized festival with folk costumes at the church, or at the Narva castle, so that Narva is sort of effectively, through all these discursive practices, reimagined as Estonia, as a site of Estonianness. Okay, well, let me end then with this last process of rescaling, and that is the process of Europeanization that came along with EU accession. And as I said, this is something that certainly begins before 2004, And really goes back into the 1990s and comes in along with Estonianization. So it certainly has, it isn't separated in terms of time from that Estonianization process that's going on. Well, first of all, discursively, Narva is now talked about and written about as the easternmost outpost of Europe in the West. Right? And you can imagine, because of that visual, those two fortresses sitting there, it's a great, it's sort of a great symbolic site of the end of Europe as well. A second part of this, of course, is the promotion of Narva's European past as part of de-Sovietization, de-Russianization, and Estonianization. And the one thing that's really striking about this is not just Europeanization, but Sweden and Swedish actors are really prominently involved in this reimagining or these new discourse and practices of Europe in Narva. And that does go back to the Swedish period, and I'll talk a little bit more about that as well. So we might think about Europeanization, but also think about it as something else happening as well, and try to ask the question of why Sweden, or why Swedish actors are so interested in a place like Narva. So Narva is the easternmost outpost of the West. Some have even promoted this visual, this panoramic scene, as the new symbolic landscape of Fortress Europe. And I've seen that in a couple of magazines so far. One proposal for Lenin's replacement on the main town square, now there it is just a vacant space with some flowers planted in it. But one proposal is to put this this statue. This was sort of a mock-up, a small wooden model of Carl XII, Sweden's King Carl, facing off against Peter the Great. And you can imagine sort of the geography or the geographic visualization that one gets from this: Russia on one side, Sweden on the other. This commemorates the year 1700 when Carl XII successfully fought off and held off Peter the Great. And there are monuments to Carl XII all over the city. So one reason why Sweden is that successful holding off and holding back Russia and Russianness as sort of a symbol of both Estonianness, but also of Europe's presence here. The Swedish Lion, to commemorate that event in 1700, has been reconstructed on the 300th anniversary, so in the year 2000, this was built. The old monument was on a battleground outside of the city, kind of hard to get to on the main battleground that was fought. This one, you can see the Danish fortress in the background, is right on the river, so again, lining things up on the border, but also it's in the center of the city. It is a site on the tourist route now as well, and really a part of the city. It's been sort of incorporated by local Narvans in other ways too, and we can talk maybe a little bit about that if there's time and question and answer.
The flag, the red flag, what was that in the last slide?
That is the flag that comes from the period of this past, but I don't know. This was a staging of what it might have looked like in 1700. Of course, it was just done in the last couple of years, but it's not Sweden's flag, as far as I know. I didn't ever think to ask that question. Other monuments to 1700, this is to soldiers who died, and you can see the river in the background. So again, on the riverbank, right along this border or this edge. This re-narration of Narva's history also involves a new exhibition in the Narva Museum, which is inside the castle, the Narva Castle, and the title of this, Narva Swedish Town, 1581 to 1704, I don't know if you can see that it was funded and created by a couple of Swedish foundations and institutes. So again, it's not just sort of Estonian actors or EU actors transforming Narva, but it is particularly Swedish actors involved. And this, the text of the narrative here, of course, ends with the story of Carl XII's victory, but throughout this is the high water mark socially, economically, culturally for Narva when Sweden was in control. And this period of Swedish control then is sort of seen as the authentic, the real Narva, in opposition to what happens after 1704, the Imperial Russian era, and then after World War II with the Soviet period as well. So you can see in casting back to this point, sort of excising Russians and Russianness in particular from the storyline of Narva. Here's the town hall built during the Swedish period that, as I said, is the point of staging a lot of these cultural events. It is a site that is being restored. The other thing that's happening that's not in this slide because it just happened in the last year or so is that off to the left here, the old Swedish trade building is being reconstructed to house the Narva College. So they're using the old Swedish facade. Now it's just a hole in the ground, but they're reimagining this downtown, the old Narva, old town Narva, to try and remake that image of a Swedish architectural landscape. And then, of course, the new Europe as well. Here's a hotel that was just built, the name of the hotel, Europe, with the stars around it. They got the stars a little wrong. They're red instead of blue. I'm not quite sure why. And then the EU's flag flying alongside the Estonian flag all over the city. So in many ways, sort of Europe is showing up as the new Europe that Estonia is entering. Well, how to make sense of this all, and how do these things fit together? I think if I think back over the 1990s and up to the present time, there really is a turning point that happens in much of this region, but particularly in Estonia, in terms of that nationalization mission and sort of what it meant to be independent in Estonia. At first, in the early part of the 90s, nationalism and national self-determination sort of dominating the discursive practices in the state. And the idea, basically, we've just regained our independence from the Soviet Empire. We are going to sort of live the dream, in other words. We're a nation in our own homeland. We have control of our own destiny. And national self-determination was dominant. There was sort of a great reluctance to join transnational organizations and really resistance to sort of moving westward into things like the EU during this period of time. That carries over even today, popularly. I mean, the public as a whole was not terribly favorably disposed towards the EU. But by the mid to late 1990s, within Estonia, political elites and economic elites in particular began to change that discourse and emphasize both the idea of a return to Europe, but also this idea that there is no in-between. We can't successfully stand as an independent nation state between Russia and the EU. One way or another, we have to decide. We have to decide whether we're in Europe, we're in the EU, or if we're out here on our own, Russia will reabsorb us again. So that sort of way of talking about Russia on its knees today, but when it gets back on its feet, it will become imperialistic again. A lot of sort of ethnic stereotyping, of course, about this, and even racism that, well, Russians just can't help themselves, it's in their blood kind of thing. So we better be on the right side of the border before that happens. So this idea of EU entry was being used by nationalizing actors in Estonia to reinforce both where they belonged in this return to Europe, but also where Narva belonged. And this is a period of time, as I said, where that process of reimagining Narva and interiorizing Narva as part of Estonia, part of Europe, is sort of beginning to really get traction. So here are the two flags flying side by side at the end of the Bridge of Friendship, where the passport control office is. Here now, the border station, instead of just being a border crossing between Estonia and Russia, now there's a lane for EU citizens and a lane for others. In terms of this discourse of return to Europe, Lennart Meri, the Estonia's first post-Soviet president, basically brings Europe out to the border with statements like this. It's precisely in the name of European values that Estonia needs a secure border. Our border is the border of European values. So it's bringing Europe, stretching it over all of Estonia and stretching it out to the border. So this idea of return to Europe, obviously a way of Estonia to sort of place itself in the West, or Estonian actors to place that understanding of Estonianness in the West in this rescaling process, but also very disruptive out in the border areas themselves, reinforcing the divide between Ivangrad and Narva in particular, reinforcing those separations, lengthening the time it takes to cross. The last time through since the EU came, they've added things like sniffer dogs to sniff all the bags for contraband and drugs and things like that. Regularly, someone looking like they're from Uzbekistan or Central Asia are pulled off the buses that may have to sit there an extra 2 or 3 hours as these folks are interrogated. So the coming of the EU, crossing with food, also now undergoing very strict guidelines and restrictions as part of those EU standards. So the EU coming to the border has not made things easier, but done just the opposite. And in addition to that, of course, the last thing I have here is that the EU and EU accession has also been used imaginatively by Estonian political elites to coerce Estonian citizenship out of those who didn't get it automatically at the end of the Soviet period. Now, just that idea of no in-between, and President Meri is just great for these quotes. He's really the best. This one in 1999, and this is the time when this became sort of the primary advertising message in the campaign for joining the EU. And it was an active campaign on TV, on radio, in magazines, and so on. And this image, on one side Europe, on the other Russia, we're on the border. So again, no in-between. We can't be a nation state between the two. And therefore, only a small push is needed to make us fall. I should have highlighted fall, I suppose, into one side. We can understand and imagine which side that is, or rise into the other, right? And so this idea of we know what's going to happen if we don't make this the right decision here. And this became sort of the drumbeat leading up to the referendum on accession, beginning in about 1998, 1999. This idea of coercing citizenship, there is an integration program, and so one thing we could say is that the non-Estonian population was successful in the sense that in order to join the EU, the price of admission for Estonian nationalizing elites was to accept the non-Estonians, to accept the Russians in their midst, to engage in an integration program. This is a poster that comes out of that program, and I'll say a little bit more about that just as I wrap up. You can see a lot of the visual images, a stoplight with the European blue, the word go in English, of course, the Estonian passport. On one side of this is presented on the day of citizenship. And on one side in Russian, it says, if you're a citizen of Estonia, Europe is for you a place without borders. On the other side of this poster in Estonian, it says, as citizens of Estonia, Europe is for you a place without borders. So a very sort of different messages being given that, you know, Russians have to choose, have to go through the process of naturalization to gain citizenship, and or they'll be locked out of the rest of the EU, which in fact they are if they don't have blue passports. Another way in which these things are coming into focus, but also I think coming into as points of tension in this these rescaling discursive practices on the ground was seen in 2005. This is the 60th anniversary of the end of World War II. As I said, May 9th, the day of liberation, still celebrated in Russia, of course, and still celebrated in Narva. But Estonia did not recognize this as a national holiday. They gave no money for the celebrations, for the fireworks or anything in Narva. They proclaimed it a Day of Europe, and in fact, locally booked this, which is the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Narva, and which is where the veterans always sort of congregate to hold their rally on the Day of Liberation. Those who proclaimed the Day of Europe booked that site to have a day-long session of a day-long conference and commemorative events about both the occupation of the Soviet Union, but also about sort of the birth of Europe during this period of time. So that holding EU and holding Europe itself up against Russia, the Soviet past, and Russianness is really sort of coming into contestation in the site itself. those who pressed that idea of a day of Europe and holding this site finally backed down. It was looking, I mean, they called all the police out. It was looking like it was going to be serious. And then you look at the faces, and I mean, these are veterans. They're all in their 80s. This is sort of the last hurrah for these folks. So sort of calmer heads or cooler heads prevailed, and they got their sort of last chance to celebrate at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. But in the city itself, the EU flags flew for the Day of Europe, and as I said, sort of no money given for any of the Day of Liberation celebrations by the state. Okay, well, what do the locals make of all of this, and sort of how do they try to respond to it? Because they aren't sort of sitting there passively necessarily taking it, and very few of them are leaving either, which is, I think, most of the idea behind the Estonianization. The local population, as I said, overwhelmingly defines itself not in ethnic terms, not in national terms, but in very localized terms. So the prominent scale effect that continues to be dominant during this period of post-Soviet history is that localism. We're Narvans, and I've got this one quote, which I think sort of captures what a lot of people sort of feel about the place and about their place in it. It is sort of the only place we feel at home. It is our home, and we have no other place to go. So this idea of we are Narvans, this belongs to us, also results in a profound sense of isolation. They don't feel, the population in Narva doesn't necessarily feel at home or welcome anywhere else in Estonia, and feels insecure to travel that way, but also has a hard time crossing the border, as you've seen, to go into Russia or do anything on that side, and overwhelmingly feels that Russia isn't our homeland either. We might feel connected to St. Petersburg. We might want to go there for some cultural events and things like that, but really, that's about it. This is our home. So that sense of isolation and separation is very strong for this population. And as I said, the population hasn't been passive. There's a great degree of social activism, and the social activists are trying to engage in what those who work in the politics of scale literature would call scale jumping. They're trying to sort of go over the heads of those actors who represent Estonia as a nation state. They're trying to bring actors representing Europe, representing the Nordic Council, representing others into the picture to try and empower themselves, to put themselves back in the story or the time space of Narva in this post-independent period. And as I said, they've had some successes. Minority rights laws have been passed mostly through pressure from the Council of Europe and to some extent from the EU. Citizenship laws and naturalization laws have been passed that have opened up the possibility of citizenship. The integration program, as I mentioned as well, are all sort of evidence that scale jumping has had some effect. There have been some success by this population. However, if you think about these processes and sort of this idea of the politics of scale and sort of that scaling process and who controls, the overwhelming evidence that I could come up with is that actors representing Estonia as a nation state have really successfully controlled and orchestrated this scale jumping, this Europe-Narva interaction or relationship. They control the integration program is one example of that. The Integration Foundation has its headquarters in Tallinn. They get all the money from the West, and then they decide what projects to fund. The projects, not surprisingly, are projects that emphasize Estonianization and Europeanization in Narva. So bringing the Estonian language there as a mark of integration, bringing Estonia's history and culture there and into the textbooks and things like that is the idea of integration. The other side of it is bringing Russian kids to Estonian farm families for the summer to be immersed in the Estonian language. Well, that sounds fine. It's almost like a fresh air fund that exists in the United States. But if you think about the idea of the Estonian farmer as sort of that symbolic representation of Estonianness, the true Estonian out there close to the soil, you can imagine sort of the driving impetus behind this. We're going to not necessarily Estonianize this population, or integrate by sort of finding some common ground, but we're basically going to tell this non-Estonian population how it really can never be Estonian and how it really doesn't properly belong here. And that's sort of the overwhelming feeling you get both from those who are participating in the program and also as you read through some of these texts. And again, that EU poster, the citizenship poster, sort of one poster that comes out of this process. The second thing, and it's a complicated story, and I don't want to get into complicated stories necessarily now, is the question of economic development. So I'll just say this very quickly. With EU accession, actors representing the Estonian state, and particularly the Estonian state, the interior ministry, and the budget, basically said, well, it went out to places like Narva and said, well, you can't really count on the Estonian budget to fund development, to fund roads, to fund infrastructure anymore. There's a structural fund in the EU, and you have to turn to that. You're going to have to get your development from the EU. We're in the EU now. Well, okay. And okay if that happened sort of equally around the country, but it really didn't. It happened in a number of sites, and Narva being one of them. And then the second thing you realize is that the structural funds from the EU don't go all over the country. They go to Tallinn, to a board that sits in Tallinn that then takes proposals from all over the country and decides what to fund and what not to fund. The original plan by the EU was to create regional boards, four regional boards, and these actors in Tallinn basically went to the EU and said, well, look, we're a small country, and it'd be much more effective and efficient if you just sent the money to us, and we'll figure out how to use it. And in fact, that argument convinced the EU. The structural funds do go to Tallinn, and so they're dispersed in particular kinds of ways. Not surprisingly, the funds that come to Narva are funds like that one to relocate Narva College into Old Town to recreate Sweden in Narva in that kind of context, but not funds to do other sorts of things that Narvans might prefer, like create shopping malls that have movie theaters and other things that are currently lacking in the city. So my conclusion here is just this is more for those folks that work in the politics of scale literature that look at these global local interactions as sort of evidence of local empowerment, that scale jumping to look for those intersections or interaction isn't enough. You really have to understand where the power is. Who says jump and how high? And here it's clearly those actors representing Estonia and Estonian Narva that are calling the shots. And this is my last slide, I think. It's close. Anyway, so to conclude then, if we think about this sort of actors and the scalar stances they take, actors engaged in rescaling Narva as Estonia have worked to both interiorize Narva, but to exteriorize the so-called non-Estonians or the Russians living in Narva from the city, which is being pulled into Estonia. And the second part of this then in this post-Soviet period is Narva as Europe is a set of discursive practices that work together and not separate from or apart from Estonianization, imaginatively pulling Narva into the West, separating it from avant-garde Russia, Russianness as well, and the East. And this is the last slide, and I'll close with another quote from President Meri as to why EU accession. Why these Estonian political elites decided that it was necessary to join the EU. And it wasn't because Europe or the EU had anything in particular to offer except Estonianness. And this quote, I think, captures that nicely. We don't need the EU for its own sake. We need the Estonian Republic, a state that the Estonians would feel as one that guarantees them the prerequisites for raising their standard of living and for educating their children. And so nationally focused statement. And for this end, we need to join Europe, and really for no other reason. So pulling Europe out, stretching Europe over Estonia, is really almost a security blanket of Estonianness, if you want to think about it in those kinds of terms. And I'll leave it there. Thanks a lot.
I was going to say, one reason I think for the extensive use, like you mentioned, the use of the flag in the church, even though that is unusual, and, you know, the ethnic costumes and the display of the flag throughout the city, isn't part of that due to the fact that that sort of display was so totally forbidden under Soviet rule in any of the Baltic states?
I suppose, but it also is sort of where it's presented. And these two flags flying side by side. Interestingly, the flag of Narva comes out on some city occasions, but very few people can even tell me what that flag is when I look at it and I point to it. So it's not just flags, because now we can wave flags, but it's particular flags at particular moments to sort of tell a story about Narva in particular ways that I think is an important point, although some of these flags do fly all the time. Yeah.
But, I mean, that was so completely suppressed during Soviet rule. I mean, any type of, any evidence of nationalism.
Well, nationalism in that flag would have been seen as a nationalistic
right.
flag. Other flags of the Estonian Republic, of course, could fly, but they were of the Socialist Republic.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit more about the process of creating the order and what people were thinking as that happened? How did they have any choice about which side to be on, or was it just predetermined?
Yeah, for the most part, it was predetermined on the side that you were on. There was a process of attempting to relocate Narvins to the east. And even a migration program that gave funds for resettlement, and I think the title of the program was Resettlement into Your Ancestral Motherland. And of course, a lot of these people had been born in Narva, and they were being sent to places that they'd never been and never imagined themselves going to, but nonetheless, the idea of, so this can't be your homeland, it's over there somewhere. So there was that sort of process in the works, but as I said, relocation was, you know, very few relocated in that sense. Most of those on the Narvin side stayed there. Some on the Evangorod side attempted to move across, but were more or less prevented from this. As I said, they lost their jobs. So there was very little ability, really, to move across. And Evangorod has been in very dire straits since. So it's very distinctive sort of separation, since most of the economic activity that was in the city ended up on the Narvin side. Now, at first, while you couldn't relocate in that sense, once you were sort of sited in one of these, there was a period of time where there was visa-free crossing, that there were sort of lists and you could move across without a visa and free of charge. So there was that period. That clamped down in part from with the EU coming, again, Estonian actors who sort of wanted to close the border more tightly anyway, basically said, well, the European Union's coming and we need to have visas now. So they limited the number of visas, 2,000 to each side in the north and 2,000 on each side to the south. And of course, in the south, it's a rural area and the visas aren't really needed there. There are a lot more needed in the north than in the south. Those who got it had to have relatives or grave sites of ancestors on one side or the other, and they could cross with that visa. Then this last wave is there are free visas, but it's increasingly difficult to get them, and you have to sort of go and get them. And the cost of getting the visas is increasingly difficult for especially the older generation. And all through this period, the last 2 years, the idea of the EU is here now, we've got to cancel these free visas. We just can't have this anymore because Europe won't like this, doesn't want this. So far as I know, and I've been trying to keep up with the news from Narva, the visa regime, that free visa regime is still in place. But what they've done then instead of that is a lot of people use that visa, particularly on the Evangorod side where there's high unemployment, to cross to sell goods on the Narva side where there was more money, and they could cross with, I think, up to 10 kilos in the past. So they were basically day traders. In 2004, They restricted that again with the pretext, at least, that the EU is coming to 1 kilogram that you could go across, and very few people could make any money. One of the big farm markets that existed because of this day trade closed down. So there are all kinds of efforts to sort of squeeze out that movement back and forth. So there was possibility. It was much freer early on, and it's become much more difficult now. And as I said, the EU's coming has, if anything, made it worse. But another part of this rescaling and the utility of Europeanization was shown here as well. And those actors who represent Estonia also went out and said, look, our hands are tied. You know, we don't have any choice. It's EU rules and such, and we just all have to live with them, so we're going to have to make it more difficult for you. And so the locals could understand the border. They can understand the need to maybe have checkpoints and cross, but they can't understand why the border has to cut them off from their kids and their brothers and relatives and these sorts of things in the way that oftentimes they do. Also, if you don't live in the border area, so if you happen to move away from Ivangorod, you don't have access to the free visa anymore. And this is more of a problem in the south, in this more rural area that I study, that I'll talk more about on Tuesday. Yeah, there are these islands. Yeah, there are these islands, and part of it was a negotiation, too. And on one of those islands, Krenholm actually was built on an island. So that went to Narva. The hydropower plant also on an island, and that went to Russia. So as they're sort of moving through this space, there are also these sorts of things. So the river sort of standing as that physical geographic marker of difference, but... Yeah, then there are lots of sort of specifics about where it gets drawn. And there's also all kinds of stories about fishermen, mostly men, who wade out into the river, and how far can they wade out, with all kinds of consequences if they go too far, and most don't pay much attention, but some have been arrested, and so that became an issue after EU accession as well. And again, sort of another way of tightening up the border. This is a river that sort of lots of people line up along both sides of the riverbank and fish on a daily basis. So it wasn't seen as anything out of the usual for what Narvans would do, right? So. Sure. Yeah, you can imagine as a place that is feeling relatively separated and isolated, it isn't a place where Estonian is heard very often, except in these corridors of power, right? So in the mayor's office, in these different offices, in the director's office at the Narva Castle, at Narva College. And Narva College actually is a teaching college, and one of their primary missions is both to teach the local population how to teach, but also and fundamentally about how teaching them how to read and write Estonian, how to learn Estonian, and also beyond that, the other elements of Estonianness, Estonian culture, Estonian history, and so on. Now, there are other ways that the Estonian language comes in, and I had a slide, and I dropped it because I thought 53 slides was just too many. There is a place called Estonian Home that was created by, again, the Integration Foundation and the Integration Program that actually is on the site of the Narva College. And their job is to give out applications for citizenship. They publish very basic beginner Estonian textbooks to promote Estonian language learning, and really have that as their mission to bring Estonian language and culture into Narva. And even on the cover of their brochure, they say, you know, Narva is a city in Estonia, but from Narva, Estonia looks far away, and from the rest of Estonia, Narva looks even farther away. So this idea of is it inside or outside, regardless of where the border is. And so the mission of Estonian Home is to bring the Estonian language and culture to Narva and have them introduce themselves, I think is the phrase they use. Now, I think Estonian Home tries to do some other things as well. They try to highlight the good features of the city of Narva, and to bring delegations and groups of Estonia, of different populations of within Estonia out to the city to show them it isn't necessarily a place of crime and danger and disease. But there are other things happening here as well. And they also have delegations that they sponsor of Narvans to go out to the rest of Estonia to try and get some kind of real integration happening beyond that, just transplanting Estonianness into Narva. But that was their primary mission when they started and remains their main mission. I talked to the director last year who was not from Narva. Again, a parachuted in Estonian from a rural area who had not a clue about Narva, Narvans, anything about the place. And he was very discouraged about how the integration program was going. His basic assessment was it's just not going anywhere. The local population doesn't accept it as integration, as you might imagine. They offered their own definition of integration and try to work with different European actors to bring that about. But the integration program is sort of soundly rejected in places like Narva.
The slide you had about the main nine liberation. Was that the Russian flag that they were flying?
The Russian flag, the Estonian flag, and the Soviet flag.
And the people that were the day of commemoration looked like the Russian flag. Is that
this day of liberation? Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any policy that I imagine?
Probably, and maybe in law, but it is used. I see it at Narva Castle. They will on occasion. And Narva Castle is interesting, very different from, say, Alexandria Church. That's really a site of Estonianness, and no sort of Russianness is sort of welcomed inside. And it really has been a place that where the Estonian flag has been planted very firmly. In Narva Castle, lots of different things go on. You saw that sort of new Swedish exhibition about the history of Narva, sort of retelling what Narva is all about. There are all sorts of Baltic folk festivals and Estonian events going, Estonian cultural festivals, and I showed you a picture from that as well. But there are also sort of Russian rock concerts that go on. And during those, the Russian flag is fairly prominently on display without any, you know, anybody sort of raising an eyebrow or saying very much about it. On official buildings in official ways, I'm sure you're right that it's not a flag that can be flown.
They had a policy to suppress people using the Russian flag for whether they would use it for weddings or anything.
Well, I think in these cultural settings, it's seen as okay. And the wedding thing sort of reminds me of the story I was going to tell about the Swedish lion. And, of course, in the Soviet Union, and in Russia generally, it's sort of traditional after a wedding to bring flowers and put them at the, you know, at the foot of Lenin. It certainly was in Narva during the Soviet period. Well, now, even though Lenin's still there, they don't go to Lenin anymore. They typically will go, most of them will go to the Swedish lion now. So, and I see this as almost a reappropriation of that, a localization or a Narvanization of those European sites, sort of making them their own. In a way, and that's sort of an interesting process that's just begun in the last year or two. Yeah.
Do you have a sense of how EU accessionist affected relations with Russia? Is this trade or? Yesterday we talked about Turkey and what Turkey's bid for the EU and how that if they don't get in, they might vote for Russia and they might try to get a better relationship with Russia.
Yeah. Well, last time Turkey was rejected, they turned to Central Asia. Yeah. Well, you know, because I've studied this on both sides. So I go to Ivangorod, and in the south, I go to Pskov and the border areas there and talk to the people there. And they have been, interestingly, on the Estonian side, the locals on the border are pretty discouraged and were right from the start. They didn't see the coming of the EU as being something that was going to have the potential to open the border or make to help sort of restore some of these social networks or some of these connections. They saw it as sort of only the downside of it. On the Russian side of the border, a lot of the local political elites in particular were thinking good things are happening on the Estonian side of the border. When the EU comes, those good things will sort of spill over. There'll be some spillover effect. It may not affect all of Russia, but it'll affect us at least. And in Pechori in particular, where there's this old monastery, there's a hope of even tourism sort of coming to the region, and EU tourists who do go to that southern region, I'll talk more about this next Tuesday, and are sort of the number one economic earner in the south in Estonia now, not agriculture, not forestry, but tourism, cultural tourism. And the hope is if the border can just sort of get open a little bit more that they'll go across. In Narva, some of those who are opposing this hard and fast, solid border have proposed, and they're making even some headway with the creation of a water park and hotel complex in the middle of the river, with the idea that you could go there from either side visa-free, and some sort of international actors are actually interested in this concept, and of course then access the fortresses from both sides. The Evangrad fortress is really cool, but it's in almost in ruins. There's nothing happening, whereas it's very well manicured on the Narvan side. If I were like an 8 or 9 year old, I'd hang out in Evangrad fortress every day. But it is just, it's outside the city. It's almost completely surrounded by the border fences themselves. So it almost becomes that island of that could maybe be linked in with the other side. And the last thing I'll say is that there have been proposals all along to put in an application to UNESCO to make this a World Heritage Site. It's one of the few sites where two fortress complexes are sort of side by side across the border from each other. Both sides say different things about why that application has never gone in. As you can imagine, on the Estonian side, on the Narvan side, we've done everything we can do, but they can't get their act together on the Russian side. On the Russian side, they don't want this, and they don't want anything to do with us. And so, you know, the application in the end never really goes forward. There have been other efforts, like Songs Without Borders, to have concerts and musicians staged on the Bridge of Friendship. All of those things get cut mostly by the Estonian side because of the need for visas and the violation of border regimes and things like that. So there have been real efforts to transgress the border, to open it up. And from the Russian side to sort of see the possibilities, there is still some degree of optimism on that side. I'm not sensing that strong optimism anymore, particularly in the last time I was in Narva, even though they're still promoting these ideas like that water park. There, you know, especially among the political and cultural elites, there was really sort of depressing to be there a year after EU accession to see how not favorably disposed they were to this, and how, you know, any optimism they had in 2004 had dissipated by then. So I think just the reality of that strong materialization through all of these ways, sort of severing those links. Yeah.
I think maybe just the last question.
Okay, and yeah. Oh, and yeah. I didn't. I mean, I emphasize sort of the cultural politics, if you will, and not so much the economics. I could say that. Well, first of all, this Estonianization, Europeanization has happened in the economic arena as well. Krenholm was owned by and nationalized, even so, controlled by the Estonian state. It almost went bankrupt during that period. It was sold in '96 to a Swedish transnational, again Sweden. Another reason why Sweden is prominently on display is their investors coming in. And what Sweden did was it cut all of its workforce, all of its sort of low-skilled labor in Sweden in this textile manufacturing, moved them to Narva. But then over the course of time, Krenholm, at the end of the Soviet period, had about 12,000 workers. And again, this was sort of high-end blue-collar labor, so these would have been people who were doing well, could have a dacha out on the Baltic Sea coast, could live a pretty good life. The workforce is now down, I believe, under 3,000. And every time anybody sort of talks about striking, of course, India and China are held up. Not surprising, we want to keep this operating, but you're costing us too much. And so, of course, some of the social activism, some of the resistance is also among that population that has experienced this process of rising unemployment. If there is crime in Narva, and I'm not suggesting there's not crime there, I'm suggesting Narva doesn't look like it's being portrayed, it is in part because there are very few prospects for anyone coming out of high school. There is an unemployment rate of about 33% or 35% now. And as I said, think about that in the context of this statement by Estonian national actors. Narva shouldn't look to Estonia for development funds. And that includes for funds to do something about the unemployment as well. I've even heard people laughingly, because of course one of the big things that happens here then is this increasing process of female labor migration into the sex trade and other things. And I've even heard people sort of smilingly or laughingly, smirkily talking about the Russian girls going out, because they have all kinds of prospects in Tallinn and places like that, and then they can come back with some cash and with some profits. Increasingly, that is sort of the network that happens either out to Tallinn or to, say, work in the hotels in Britain or in Ireland. But interestingly, with this EU accession, all of the EU is not open, even if you have an Estonian passport. You can only go to a few places that have opened up a few areas where they're recruiting very low-end labor.